This is Wide Open, a series on how to embrace change and challenge your ways of thinking so you can level up your life, open up to new experiences, and pay it forward to those who need it. I'm your host, Tony Gonzalez. All right, today's guest is Tom Bilyeu. He started the company Quest Nutrition. Quest bars, you see them all over the place. This guy is amazing. He has such wisdom. He's transitioned from building a billion-dollar company to impact theory, which is all about helping people, kind of like this show, Wide Open, helping people level up and be the best version of themselves. And that's actually how I got acquainted with him before I actually even met him. And I am very fortunate, and we are very fortunate to have him on the show today because he has some awesome insight on everything, rituals, routines, great lessons of how to be the best version of yourself. You're really gonna enjoy this one. Welcome back to Wide Open, the podcast. I'm your host, Tony Gonzalez. And today I have a very, very special guest. I knew you before I met you because I love YouTube. And I think YouTube is a tool if it's used the right way. And so I would go through all these videos and self-help, motivational. I eat that shit up. And Tom kept popping up on my feed all the time. And I would follow his interviews. But one thing that really stood out to me, what really hit me was your the videos where you speak directly to the camera and you're just spewing hot fire of information that makes you feel good, that makes you want to level up, that makes you come wide open, and you didn't miss a beat. It's amazing. I gotta ask you about your tricks of that. But before we get into that, man, I just want to tell you thank you so much for being a part of this show. Your show has absolutely helped me become the best version of myself. That's why I'm so excited for today's episode. And thank you for coming on. I appreciate it.
Dude, it is my pleasure, man. Absolutely my pleasure. I'm excited to be here.
Yeah. And then off of that, because I didn't know you. And then I'm looking at your show one day and I see Michael Strahan on there. And I'm like, I know Michael Strahan. Holy shit. And so I asked him, about you. And he was like, oh, he's a great guy. You want me to hook you up? And then he's the one who actually introduced us. Yeah. Put us on the text chain. So that's how we met. And we've gone to dinner a couple of times. Our wives have hung out.
Yes.
Lisa, your wife, my wife, October. And it's just been great. So
it has been, man.
So I appreciate it.
It's been very amazing. And may I say, that was a very surreal moment when I get a call from Michael Strahan wanting to introduce me to the, at that point, future Hall of Famer, Tony Gonzalez. I was like, wait a second, this is the most surreal phone call of my life, these two guys. So yeah, the show has brought a lot of beautiful things into my life. I will say that for sure.
But I love hearing people's backstories. I love hearing where they come from because I think that plays a big role in who you become, and the influences you had, the mentors you had. I want to hear about how you grew up all the way up until your company at Quest.
Yeah, that is a long and terrifying journey that is sprinkled with failure and self-doubt and bordering on self-loathing at times. And so I'm not the guy that anybody would have predicted to be successful. So I grew up in Tacoma, Washington, and my family sort of bounced back and forth between blue collar and white collar. For the most of my childhood, my dad was a sort of mid-level executive at a paint company. And for a while he was a mechanic. And so that was like, where we were and things. And my dad made me get, he didn't make me get remedial jobs, but I had to have a job every summer in high school. And because he worked for a paint company, I was in a paint factory, I was in a paint warehouse, I was in a paint store, like it was just around menial labor. So I remember one summer I spent with a gas mask inside of this massive vat with a huge brush, just cleaning out the inside of paint equipment. So that was
a lot of fun. You have a mask on when you're doing this, right?
I did, yes, thankfully.
Getting high.
But to give you an idea, like that was my background. And so my dad was like, look, it's going to give you character. I mean, like all the classic shit from kids who grew up in the 80s. This suffering will make you better. And the funny thing is he was absolutely right. But it also made me really push back hard against that. And I think that was part of his hope that I would get educated. And so my family was just assumed that you were going to go to college. But I had cheated my way through high school and I had this belief in my head that I could do it, but that I just had other priorities. And now it's so absurd. And I want to go back and punch myself in the face for thinking like that. Cause I could have learned a lot. but sadly did not. And so I took my SATs. I took it twice. I got a 990. That was my combined score, which back then is terrible. Like a monkey's feces.
990 is actually pretty good.
Oh man.
That was better than what I did. I'm telling you right now.
You at least had talents beyond that though, that would help you get access to some amazing things. I did not. So I applied to USC Film School. I get into USC, but not the film school. I go there not realizing there's even a difference. So when I left for college, by the way, I panicked and like basically tried to chicken out. And my mom all but kicks me out of the nest. And she's like, no, you're going to do this. You've got to go. You need to chase your dreams. And so I end up going and I get there and I ask the admissions committee, like, hey, look, because they wanted a 1300 on your SATs to get into film school. And I had a 990. So I wasn't off by a little, I was off by a lot. So I was like, ooh, how am I going to pull this off? The one sort of clever idea I had was there was a guy in the admissions committee who would let people join him for lunch. And so I thought, this is perfect. I'm going to take this guy out to lunch. I'm going to figure out like what I need to do. And so I ask him, I say, okay, look, I want to get into film school. My SATs are terrible. Like, how do I get in? And he said, look, man, you've already missed the window as an incoming freshman. So you're not eligible again until your junior year, which means you'll have had 2 years of college under your belt. SAT just stands for Scholastic Aptitude Test. It's supposed to tell me how well you're going to do in college. I'm just going to look at your grades. So for 2 years, I didn't party, I didn't drink, I didn't date, nothing. I literally studied. I worked and worked and worked and studied and ended up getting better grades in college than I'd gotten in high school while I was cheating off of some of the smartest people I've ever met. And that was, I wish I could say, oh, I realized something about myself, hard work pays off and you know that it changed my life. Unfortunately, that didn't quite work like that, but it did get me into film school and I sort of become one of the people to watch. But at this point, I have a fixed mindset. So I think, well, I'm naturally talented at filmmaking. That's why I wanted to do this in the first place. I've been making movies since I was 12 on like my dad's camcorder. And I just thought, you either have it or you don't, man. And there's no getting better. There just is you proving that you already have something. And through one fluke, it ended up looking like that was true. And the fluke was I had one insight that most student filmmakers don't have, which is, don't try to tell a feature film in 4 minutes with no sound, because these were all silent films back then. Try to tell a story where you wouldn't expect people to talk. And so it's just one moment. You're not expecting them to talk anyway. So you don't notice that it's a student film, essentially. And that insight made it look like my films were better than they were. So I start getting selected. Like I got an ideal partner for what's called a 310, which is like already a big deal. And so I was being watched, and then only 4 people in your entire class get to direct a 480. And that's like your senior thesis. So statistically speaking, take this for what it's worth, it's harder to get into Harvard Law than it is to get into USC Film School. The number of people that apply to get accepted.
So no, it's harder to get into Harvard Law. It's harder correct. To get into USC.
Harder to get into USC than Harvard Law. Uh-huh. So people were like, wait, if you think you're going to get in, like you're crazy. So the admissions committee, or sorry, the counselors told me, you're not going to get in. So stop taking classes like you've already been accepted. It doesn't make any sense. And we see this all the time. You're going to end up being here for a 5th year because you acted as if you'd been accepted when really, again, like I said, I wasn't eligible again until my junior year, but I had to take general education classes. So I was taking them like I'd been accepted. I told them, look, I'm going to get in. I've got my nose down. I'm doing the work. So I get in. So I already feel like I've defied the odds. Then I get the like perfect 310 partner. I feel like I'm just made for this. Then I get selected as one of only 4 people to do a senior thesis. So I'm like, this is it, dude. Yeah. I'm going to make the senior thesis. I'm going to graduate with like this perfect film. I'm going to get the 3-picture deal. And that's going to be that. Like George Lucas was another person that had done the senior thesis.
Yeah.
So it's like, I was like, here it comes. Man. I'm the next Spielberg. It's all good, man. Yeah. And I crash and burn so horribly on my senior thesis film. And I realized something that is not me being humbled. This is the truth. And what I really want people to hear this, because hopefully it'll be a beacon of hope for somebody who realizes this truth and they don't need to shy away from it. And the thing that I realized was I had no talent. And in realizing that I had no talent, that I did not know what I was doing, that I only had this one key insight. And once that was no longer relevant, once I was telling longer, more complicated stories that actually had dialogue, I had no insights. And so the film was just abjectly terrible. And it was so bad that I ended up stealing the master tape of my senior thesis so that it could never be played again. And I was like, yeah, this is just super embarrassing. And so I remember calling my mom from a payphone from the middle of campus and I was laying down on the ground. I'm on the phone and I'm like, cause my people in my class started making fun of me. They were making essentially what we would now call a meme. Didn't have that word back then, but memes out of my film, like cutting it into these funny little loops and stuff to make fun of it. And I was like, I've completely failed. I have no idea how to break into the industry now. I just feel lost and hopeless and, you know, flirting with depression and I don't know where to go from here. Mm. And then my parents stopped helping me financially as soon as I graduated. So this is all happening at once. So I no longer have parental support. I realize the truth, which is that I don't have talent. And I am now flirting with depression. So I can't afford to furnish my apartment. I'm sitting on the floor. At one point, actually a little bit before that, but at one point I was sleeping on an air mattress and it deflated in the middle of the night and I woke up on the floor every morning. I mean, it was like
depressed. Did you, during that depressed time, what were you going through? Did you turn to anything else like substance? Did you start smoking weed? You start drinking? You start doing disruptive behavior?
My mom somehow, and I wish I knew how because I would pass it on to other people. She made me so afraid of drugs and alcohol that I didn't have my first drink until I was 26. And even then I was so paranoid. I was like, sip. Like I don't know what I expected to happen. I just thought that it would somehow, one, there's a lot of alcoholics in not my immediate family. So not my mom, dad, or sister, but in my extended family. And so I saw how they acted and I just thought, not a good look.
Yeah.
So that was not my problem, but I didn't have any coping mechanisms. I didn't know how to, process my way through it. I didn't know how to meditate or anything like that. So it was just like this, what I now call background radiation. So I had this like deep sense of impending doom, unease, like, where's my life going? I have no idea what I'm doing or how to get out of this. And that I think really captures it. I didn't know how to get out of the circumstance. So it was like, all right, I'm a failure. That's how I thought of it. I don't have talent. There was no YouTube. So the industry just seemed so big and so impossible to break into because even a no budget film was $100,000. Now, growing up the way that I grew up, I didn't have access to money. I had never met anyone in my life with $100,000.
Yeah.
So not only did I not know how to raise money, I couldn't even go try to raise money for my family. So there was a hopelessness of just like, my dreams are never going to come true. So then I go into what I call the king of remedial jobs phase of my life, where I feel like the truth of who I am has been revealed. I don't have potential. Nobody's ever really expected much from me. I now don't, like I have big dreams, but I don't know how to see them through. So I've always been very ambitious. I always knew one day I would be rich. I always knew one day I would have six pack abs. I always knew one day I would be successful at film. I just didn't know how. And that gap of like knowing what you want, but having no idea how to make it come true is really distressing. So I sat in that for a long time.
How long?
That's probably about a 3-year period of my life.
Okay, it's a long time.
Super dark period. And I don't immediately get out of that, but I start to cobble together what we now call a growth mindset, but Carol Dweck had yet to write her seminal and transformative book. Oh my God, so
great
good.
Book.
And honestly, I think it would have shaved years off of my learning curve if I'd had it, but I didn't. So, but I start reading about the brain. And I don't even remember what it was that made me go, hey, you live life through the brain. Maybe you should learn about this. So even though I don't know that this is true, I'm going to pretend that it is because it's a great story, that it was The Matrix. It would have been something like that because stories had always had a massive impact. And a year after I graduate, the movie The Matrix comes out. And that movie, while at the time it wasn't transformative in my life, I'd be lying to say that it was, but it planted a seed in my mind. It gave me what has now become the dominant metaphor of how I see the human condition, which is that belief is the most important thing. It's not the only thing that matters because you actually have to put in the work. But you have to believe that if you put in the work, that you will get rewarded by improving. And that was the thing that I was missing because I realized I didn't have talent, but I had a fixed mindset. And by Carol Dweck's definition of a fixed mindset, somebody with that believes their talent and intelligence are fixed traits set at birth. They are what they are and there's nothing you can do about them. And life is about optimizing your life for the talents that you do have, which is why I was the king of remedial jobs. I valued myself for being smart. So the problem with that is I'm not that much smarter than your average person, if at all. Like I'm a pretty average guy when it comes to intelligence. And I'll explain in a minute all the people that just assumed I was going to fail in my life. And people are always like, they misidentified you. And they didn't. They accurately identified where I was at that moment. What none of them knew, and certainly what I didn't know, was that I could get better. So anyway, let's say that seeing The Matrix plants the seed that I need to believe that I can get better. And then if I put in the work, then I actually can. So whether that was it or not, something compelled me to start reading about the brain. Start reading about it, and I realized in the late 90s, there was this hotly contested idea of brain plasticity. Now it's totally taken for granted that the brain is plastic. But in the late 90s, it was this raging debate. Can you teach an old dog new tricks or not? And there was a long-standing belief that you're born with a certain number of neurons and they're dying off as you get older. And that's why people that are older perform poorly. And it's this slow senescence, basically. And there was this new thing coming out saying, no, that's actually not true. The hippocampus is making new brain cells until the day you die. And they're around memory. You can change the synaptic wiring of your brain. You could get good at music as an adult and it will actually change the auditory cortex of your brain. Like it will actually change the way that it's wired. Crazy.
Fascinating. Man. Fascinating so stuff interesting. Coming out about
that. And so I was like, all right, hold on. I choose to believe this is true. Whether it's true or not, I don't know. I choose to believe that it's true because it's so much more empowering. It felt like this huge weight was lifted because it wasn't a death sentence to not be talented. It was like, oh shit, well, maybe I could get better at this if I'm willing to put in the work. So that sort of plants a seed. It wasn't like transformative. It's not like I would say, hey, there's a line in the sand and I'm different from, you know, this moment on. But it made me start reading about the brain. I started learning more and more about the way that the brain works and how we interpret the world through our brain and all that. And we can get more into that later. It is arguably the most interesting thing anybody should know about themselves, but not to derail the story right now. So I started believing in that right at the time somebody asked me to be a teacher. Those two things together end up changing everything for me. So I now have this like niggling idea that maybe through effort, you can get better at something. And then I start teaching and my job was to help other people get better. And I realized, I'm actually able to do that. So whatever ability they come in with, after interacting with me and all the things that I've learned through the School of Hard Knocks, I actually improved their filmmaking. So I started thinking, well, wait a second, if I can help them get better, why can't I help myself get better? So then I start to become obsessed with this notion of learning. And I just start reading voraciously about the mind, about learning, about how to get better. And I begin this process of cobbling together a growth mindset, but I still don't have it. And in this period, I meet the woman who will become my wife. And this leads me into actually the darkest period of my life. So I now have this belief that I can get better. I don't know how much. I don't know what the upper limits of it are. I'm just good enough to realize that I'll never be a genius like Steven Spielberg or Stanley Kubrick or somebody like that. And that really messed with me.
Yeah.
And so because I didn't want to find my upper limit, I just didn't try. And so this is when I meet my wife and I'm her teacher. And so she sees me at my best and we fall in love and it becomes this whole thing. I go to ask for her father's hand in marriage and for his blessing. And he says, no. He asked me, he says, look, my daughter, because he was very successful, is very successful. And he said, my daughter's become used to a certain standard of living. How do you plan to take care of her? And I was like, I gave a really kind of arrogant answer, if I'm honest, but it was very truthful. I really believed it when I said it. And what I said was, sir, look, what I know what you see is a young, broke kid. And I was out of work at the time. I didn't even have a job, but I'm the most ambitious person you've ever met. And one day I'm going to make your daughter a rich woman. And he was like, uh-huh. And so he's always been very kind to me, but he also was not afraid to show his, like, he just didn't have any reason to believe that was true.
I have two daughters. Yeah. So I can see myself saying, hey, what are you going to do?
Yes.
Because they come from this and you can't provide that right now from what I'm seeing. So what's your plan before I give you my blessing? So
exactly. And now imagine the person has the worst, like most vague plan of all time. Mm-hmm. And that you know humans well enough that he was looking at me and saying, this guy doesn't have the drive to see it through. Mm-hmm. And he was right. And so the good news is that piece of the story, like knowing that he was doubting me and knowing now that I have what I'll call a witness to my crimes, which is my wife. And now if I fail, it's not just me that suffers, it's this other person. And so that became really important to me. And I had all the shame because at this period, and the reason I call it the darkest period of my life is my then girlfriend was the only one working. And I was staying at home and I was laying in bed for 3 to 4 hours a day, every day. Mm. And I should have been using that time to work and I wasn't. And so that really started to weigh on me big time. So I've got my father-in-law, the guy who will become my father-in-law, doesn't believe in me, thinks I'm gonna make his daughter poor. And I'm having to check myself saying, you're laying in bed 4 hours a day. Like what about this is showing that you actually have the drive to see this through? And so it started to feel really gross. and feeling like I was being fraudulent, feeling like I had said something to him and that I was telling my girlfriend, I'm going to make you rich. Like, you have no idea. I'm going to do this. And then realizing, but you're not actually doing anything. So you're professing all this. This is why I have this obsession with don't be an empty dreamer. Mm-hmm. Like, if you're going to dream, you need to have the drive to see it through. You need to have the belief that you can add skills, that you can get better, and then that those skills will have actual utility in the real world. And mm-hmm. so that starts to stack and become something, but it was born out of that like really deeply shameful period in my life where I had to finally acknowledge and accept my life is an exact reflection of the choices that I'm making. And I'm choosing to lay in bed 3 to 4 hours a day. Mm-hmm. And that is why I'm not getting anywhere.
What do you think at that time when you're lying in bed, and how long were you lying in bed?
Probably a year.
So a year of this now.
Yeah.
After the first depression, which was a smaller depression.
I never really got out of that. So I won't categorize it. The words I always use are I was sliding towards depression.
Sliding towards depression.
Because look, clinical depression is a whole nother thing. So I won't diminish what other people have gone through by saying that's where I was. I was not there. Uh-huh. I was sliding towards it. I had a deep melancholy, a sense of dread, a growing anxiety. But I wasn't crippled by it. And I was still able to connect with people and go out. But I was profoundly lazy with an aura of crushing fear and hopelessness.
That's what I want to get to. That's the word, the F word. It's one of my favorite words, you know, because I think that's kind of the beginning of everybody's quest, everybody's mission, everybody's path in life. I know that's how it was for me. And I said this in my Hall of Fame speech. It's the darkest time of my life was when I led the NFL and dropped passes. That was my deepest, darkest depression, except I went to alcohol and other things. And for you, because I've pinpointed it, I knew what I was afraid of, but I didn't know what I was afraid of. I just had this deep fear. And I want to know, were you able to pinpoint, and as you look back, what were
back
you afraid
then,
of?
Probably not. Now it is patently obvious to me.
What was the biggest fear? What was stopping
that,
you
that
from
I
getting
would
up out of bed?
Never be great. Uh-huh. So if you don't try, then you have potential, and potential is intoxicating. It's why being young is so exciting. The whole world's before you. You have so much time. And so all of that potential is that. It feels good to have that much ahead of you. So when in your mind you're like, I could become the next Steven Spielberg. And let me see if I can get this concept across, because this is very important and this is my warning to everybody. There is a rhythm to days that will lull you into thinking that there's always time to do it tomorrow. There's no sense of like the passage of time. Once you're out of school, there's no real markers, especially living in LA, Jesus, there's not even seasons. Mm-hmm. So it's just like, there's this seamless sense that things are the same. When in reality, it's like the river is rushing by you, the river of time, and you're never going to get those moments back. And as that time passes, so does some of your potential, because to really make the most of your potential, unfortunately, it requires an obscene amount of energy and an obscene amount of time. So you lull yourself into thinking you will always have more tomorrows, which of course you will not. Nothing is guaranteed. I may not make it to the end of this sentence before I have an aneurysm and die, and I'm well aware of that. So it's like, you've got to try to make the most of your time. But when I was there and I had this unidentified, deep sense of like existential dread over, I may not be good, ever be great at something because I don't have the abilities, then leaving it in the realm of potential, leaving it as an uneasy question, but at least it's unanswered, because it was far better to worry that I might not ever be great than to know I was never going to be great. And once I head down the path of execution, I am eternally walking towards finding out the answer to the question of whether or not I will ever be great. Now, of course, my mindset around all of that has changed. I don't think like that anymore, but that's exactly where I was. That's exactly what haunted me and what freaked me out. Now, the thing that I value myself for is the sincere pursuit of greatness. Whether or not I ever achieve it is literally irrelevant to me now. I don't reward myself emotionally for actual achievement. I reward myself emotionally for sincere pursuit. So that was a huge change. But back then, that's what I was afraid of.
Okay, so next steps after that, you're fed up now. You wake up one day, and was it like that? It was like all of a sudden, this day I was this way.
I have one moment that we'll get to in the story where it is an epiphany,
yeah.
A line in the sand. My life is different. The moment before that, then the moment after, but it's only happened once.
Love to hear that.
So everything else has been sort of these degrees where it's like, I get on a path. I'm really not feeling good. But the day that I actually got out of bed, I forced myself to get out of bed in 20 minutes. You know, it's like, I feel better today. That's weird. Why do I feel better taking action? Well, that's interesting. Maybe I should take action again tomorrow. You know, part of the reason that I'm not taking action is I don't like being cold. So what if I put my clothes next to the bed? So I don't have to like, and you start, oh wow, like this feels better. And so it is that spectrum of every day you're learning something new about yourself. You're optimizing your systems. You're getting a little bit better. Those, you get in a positive feedback loop. So it's encouraging you and you feed off that energy. And so that was how getting out of that sort of period of laziness goes. And then for me, I was thinking about, I had this obsession with don't play at getting rich, actually get rich. And so I know how gross this sounds to an audience today, but the truth of my existence is from the time I was a little kid, that was my North Star. I'm going to get rich.
Yeah.
And growing up the way that I grew up, look, I didn't grow up poor. I used to think I did. And then I met people who grew up truly poor and the devastating social consequences of true poverty. I did not experience that. But I grew up in a household where there were things that I wanted that my family could not provide me. And I found that deeply frustrating. So I just was, hey, I'm going to be rich. And you know, in the 80s, that was like, yeah, of course. Like everybody wanted to be rich. So just, yep, cool. So I was pursuing it all out well into my 20s. And I am just going after it. And so I'm saying, okay, are you actually pursuing wealth or are you pretending to because it's a good story to your wife? But remember, you plan to be married forever. She's going to be there if this doesn't pan out. Like if you're just bullshitting, like the day of reckoning will come where it'll be like, hey, you've been telling me that you're going to be successful for 10 years. You're not actually taking the steps. So I thought, all right, there's no way to hide from this. So I really need to start figuring this stuff out. To cut a long story short, because we could really go into a lot of detail, but to cut a long story short, I end up meeting these two entrepreneurs and they're like, look, man, you're coming to the world with your hand out. If you want to control the art, because I wanted to make films, if you want to control the art, you have to control the resources. Come with us and get rich. Mm-hmm. And I, at that point, was beginning to have the beginnings of a growth mindset. And so I thought, ooh, these guys know something about money that I don't know. And there were two things I'd promised myself as a kid. One day I'll be rich, one day I'll have six-pack abs. And they were bodybuilders who were successful at entrepreneurship. I was like, this is crazy. I don't believe in science, but I'm following these guys.
Yeah.
So even though everyone thought I was crazy, I left my teaching job to go work with these crazy entrepreneurs who were saying things that sounded too good to be true, which they didn't end up being too good to be true. They ended up being exactly what they said. And they said, look, you can have any job in this company you want, it's a startup. But you're going to have to become the right person for the job. But if you're so good and you deliver so much value, you can actually become an owner in the company. And so I worked myself literally to the bone. I was working around the clock. I did that for about 6.5 years. I'm to the point, to give you an idea of how obsessed I was about delivering results, when I moved, I picked an apartment where I could get to their house in 7 minutes or less. And I would tell my wife, okay, this apartment meets the criteria. We would actually drive it out to make sure that it was true. So, yep, you like this apartment. It meets the criteria. If that's where you want to live, we can live there. Because I wanted to, if they ever called me, remember, I'm just a copywriter. If they ever wanted me at 2 a.m. on a Saturday, I would be there in 7 minutes or less. Mm-hmm. And I wanted them to know I am dedicated to this, which was getting rich, more than anyone you've ever met in your lives. And because of that, like they started inviting me to things where I could learn and grow and get better. And I was a total buffoon in the beginning. And I will eternally be grateful to them for creating opportunities for me to learn, which I have tried to since create those same opportunities for my team. And in doing that, I started actually getting better and improving. And then I had the moment that was the line in the sand moment that changed everything in my life. And that was, I still valued myself for being smart at this point. And I was arguing for an idea in the business because it was my idea. And in my head, I don't know if you've ever had this sense when you're arguing with your wife, where your mind is like, you're wrong, dude. You know you're wrong. Shut up. Just stop. Just let it go. Just apologize.
Can't let her win though.
Yeah, right? And so that was exactly where I was. I was like, I can't lose another one of these. It will make me feel stupid. I can't fucking take this anymore. Yeah. So I finally just outlast them essentially. And they give in and we decide to do my idea. They leave. And then I have this moment of real crisis where I'm like, you have told everyone, including yourself, for years that you were going to get rich. But you just did something that moved you away from that. So I said, this, I will give myself credit for this. In that moment, I said, no judgment. It's okay. Whatever the answer to the following question is, it's okay. We just need to know what the real answer is so that we can structure your life in a way that that's going to work for you. And so do you want to be rich, which will require you to let go of your self-esteem and just follow their ideas when they're better? Or is what you really want to get rich, to feel good about yourself? And if all you want is to feel good about yourself, that's fine too, but you have to leave this company because them being smarter than you makes you feel badly about yourself every single day. So which is it going to be? And as I thought through, I thought, wow, that really is the dichotomy. The problem is I need self-esteem. I need to feel good about myself. Just neurochemically, I know where it goes if I don't feel good about myself. So I can't go down that path, but I really do want to be rich. And so is there some third option? And the insight came that if I could change what I built my self-esteem around, I could both feel good about myself and get rich. What I began to say was, I'm going to make my name in this company by always being willing to admit when I'm wrong, to learn and get better, and to identify the right answer instead of trying to be right. And when I identify the right answer, regardless of whose idea it is, I'll put all my energy behind that. So my life became radically different after that, because now all of a sudden I wanted to know why I was wrong, where I was wrong, what the right answer was. And so everything in my life shifted. And the more I fed my ego, the only way I could feed it was by being more open to being wrong, by trying to learn more, by hoping someone will tell me where I'm messing up. And so, and this was where you and I really bonded, was when you told me that you had that downtime and you were doing terribly and you realized that you had two options and that you just had to start outworking everybody to improve your skill set. And in improving your skill set, you get into the fucking Hall of Fame. Like, I love that so much. And so my life has been the business equivalent of that. If you put in time, attention, and energy to getting better, that energy will be rewarded with skills. Now, you have to be intelligent about what skills you pick, but you will be rewarded by getting better at something. That something has real world implications.
Yes. And so this is one thing that I've talked to people, movers and shakers, people that have come on and they're doing great, extraordinary things. It seems like ambition is probably the beginning, one of the beginning flames. And we can go on and on about that, but that ambition will guide you, because every time you get into a rut and you start to get depressed, which I'm really starting to believe that that is necessary. That's part of the process. You have to go through that. There's no way around it. You're going to get your ass kicked. You're going to fall down. You're going to want to quit. But as long as you keep that ambition there, you ride that pain out. And then on the other side of that is greatness. That's where the gold is. As I told to my kids, I wrote them a letter at the Hall of Fame speech. And that was a big part of it, because I know that's what I've seen in myself and that's what I'm seeing in you now. But I wanted a word that I love, and it's a little woo-woo, but I believe it's an essential part of being successful, because I know that's how it's worked for me. And the word is surrender. And you get to a point where you're like, fuck it. Like, through tears sometime, you're on your knees and you say, screw it. I'm surrendering what I think I know. I'm going to let go of that person because I'm so fed up with it. And it was like a balloon that kept building and building and building, and you just get tired of it and you let it all out. And I think Oprah Winfrey has that story. You have that story. I have that story.
I don't have that story.
Well, it seems like you got to that point where you were like, I can't do it this way. The epiphany point.
But I will violently resist the use of the word surrender.
Okay.
Now here's the
bad
What
could
news.
Be another word for surrender then?
Aggression.
Aggression.
Tenacity.
That too.
Sickness.
Uh-huh.
Drive.
Yeah.
Whatever is the opposite of surrender. The bad news is it is a very effective part of my personality. I don't know that it's as effective as surrender. Maybe surrender is better. So I'm not asking anybody to believe anything. I'm just telling you the truth of my experiences. Everything in my life has come as a result of go harder, do more. If you're not where you want to be, then you're not doing the right things. And I think coming back to that, because I'm not, and maybe this is where you get to the notion of surrender, I am not married to my approach. I don't think I'm that special. So I have no problem if somebody has criticism for me and they think, oh, well, you're not succeeding because you're doing it that way. You should try it this way. I am solicitous of that information. The way that I've built impact theory is such that every person in the company is obligated to not only tell me, but to tell each other, where are we fucking up? Like, don't try to spare people's feelings. Yeah. Be kind, always be kind, but never sacrifice clarity for kindness. Like, just tell people what's working, what's not working. Give me your opinion. Like, be very direct about it. And because I don't have my, I have a raging ego, Tony, a raging ego. However big yours is, I promise mine's bigger. But my ego is built entirely around being a learner.
Yeah.
That's it. So I'm psychotic about that. Like, if somebody wanted to really attack me, and this is funny because it's a recursive loop, they can never like actually hit me with this. But like, if you want to attack me, then you say you're not actually a learner. But because I actually am a learner, I'm going to just try to ask, whoa, what is it that you see in me that isn't like learning? Where am I being defensive or not open or whatever? Because I want to know, I want to get better. And so that, because that's my obsession, it's, I'm not having to let go of anything.
Uh-huh.
So there's nothing for me to release. I'm just constantly trying to find the right path.
Well, okay. So let me clarify it then. And maybe this makes a little bit more sense. When I say surrender, at least for me, it was admitting that I don't have all the answers. That's what I mean by surrender. So I do value what you're saying there. I'm the same way. I mean, you look up on my bookcase here. I've read all these books. I've read thousands of books on mind, body, and spirit because I'm so interested in learning because I know that I don't know everything. I know that I need to level up and I got to go to the experts. I got to listen to people. And even if they're not experts, I want to listen to my kids. Like that, that's part of like that giving up. That's what I mean by that surrender. And by the way, I want to go back to what you said where I want to make money. That's more important than doing what I love. There are people that will argue that you can have great success, but to go past that success, money, whatever, fame, or even relationships, you better start to put love. Otherwise, you can have success, but it just won't be fun. It won't be truly fulfilling for yourself if you don't love it. Because I got a very successful friend, very successful, that says, I'm not in the business of such and such. I'm in the business of making money.
Right.
And so is it okay to be at that point, or is that something while you transitioned out?
I don't advise it.
Okay.
So here's exactly what happened. So I'm at Awareness Technologies, building a tech company. I don't love it, but I'm grinding it out. Stayed there for about eight and a half years. And I didn't love anything about it. Didn't care about the product. Nothing about it spoke to my soul. Mm-hmm. So for 6.5 years, I just do it, head down. I'm going to keep doing it. My wife finally pulls me aside and she's like, this is damaging our marriage. You're working so much and you're so grumpy, basically, that this is a bad scene. So I'm like, yeah, you're right. And we start planning, like, you know, what do we do about this? And I realized that, man, I am so deeply and profoundly unhappy. And so anybody listening right now, if you're sitting at your computer watching this on YouTube, I want you to lean in. If you're driving in the car and you're listening to a podcast, pull over. Because what I'm about to tell you, no matter what you do in your life, there is no escaping the following. The punchline to life, the very definition of success, it is not wealth, it is not fame, it is not accolades. It is one thing and one thing only, fulfillment.
Mm-hmm.
That sense of, I've worked very hard to build a set of skills that I care deeply about that serves not only myself, but other people. So the irony of my life is for 20 years, all I thought about was getting rich, chasing money. That was it. I would say it daily and with no sense that it was like dirty word. I was just like, I want to get rich. And so I was obsessively focused on that and never really succeeded. And it became very clear to me, and this is another mantra people should write down, the struggle is guaranteed, the success is not. So maybe you'll be successful, but maybe you won't. But if you love what you're doing along the way, does it really matter? And I had the very good fortune of, in building Quest, the way that we came up, it was like, we were just putting everything back into the company. So I was worth hundreds of millions of dollars on paper, but my bank account was normal. And so all of my money came at once.
Mm-hmm.
Literally, you knew what day the money was going to be wired. We took a small investment, but a small investment at $1 billion, a lot of cash. So it was like, you're hitting refresh in your bank account, refresh, mm-hmm. refresh. And then boom, all of a sudden you've got this just insane amount of money. And so the lesson I got to learn there was it did not change how I felt about myself in the slightest.
Nothing.
All of my insecurities still there. all the things that I felt were positive about me were still there and untouched. The person I had to become in order to be good enough to make the money, that changed how I felt about myself. But whether or not I ever actually got the money was irrelevant in how I felt about myself. Now, it's allowed me to do things. So again, money's extraordinary. But in terms of addressing the problems of you and how you feel about yourself, depression, anxiety, any of that stuff, money cannot help you, not in the slightest.
Yeah, yeah, that's funny. It's kind of like as athletes, when you sign that mega deal worth your $100 million or 50, whatever it is, and all of a sudden you are different. Literally, one stroke of the pen, you've gone up here. Nothing changes. Nothing. I've signed those big mega deals and you feel the same way. You walk in, now you're proud. You're like, man, I put all this work. I busted my ass, but nothing changes emotionally. And I think that's a key lesson. I'm glad you brought that up. I know for football, for me, I always go back to that second year. I liked football up to that point. I liked it a lot. Mm. I loved basketball. Now, when I was a kid, oh, I would go out and play on the court. I'd go out by myself. I had a freaking basketball that I would dribble around campus at Berkeley. Like people are like, yeah, I always saw you, Tony, because you had that basketball with you. My backpack on, I'm dribbling to class because I loved basketball. I loved the smell of a basketball. I was obsessed with it, but I didn't have that feeling towards football. I liked it a lot. And until I was able, and I was good, obviously. I mean, I was a first round draft choice and it got me to the league and I had talent too. But until I could say, and I had to fall in love with football. And I'd never given it a chance because basketball came, but basketball got taken away from me. And I tell my kids this all the time. If you love something, the need for discipline will disappear. Some things take discipline. Like me, if I want to cookies, I love cookies. And so I need discipline to walk by a store that's selling some great cookies, not to go in there. I need to have to tell myself, and I'm a pretty disciplined person, so I can keep walking for the most part. Sometimes I do slip up and I got to go in there and get me a cookie. But when it came to football, once it clicked for me, it's like, why wouldn't I stay after practice? I mean, why wouldn't I want to watch extra film? It's not, yeah, I'm grinding my ass off. Like you said, it's funny how when you went to what you love, that's when you're working even the hardest. So what do you recommend? Because that took a while for you and it took a while for me, to the people listening out there, especially young athletes. I'm sure a lot of athletes are going to be there, or business entrepreneurs, young people. How do you find what you love? How do you get to that point?
So this is one of the most important things for anybody that wants to achieve greatness has to understand. There's almost certainly, I mean, some people are lucky, there's no question. And from the time they were young, they just loved something and they knew it and it was good. The vast majority of people, they don't know what they love. They don't have a passion. And so all of this notion, follow your passion, doesn't help them because they're like, I don't have a passion. So I think this is a process. So I think the process goes like this. You find something that you're interested in. Now you do need to actually be interested at least. Mm-hmm. It warrants more attention than something else in your life. Then you engage with it deeply. And if the more you engage with it, the more fascinated you become by it, that's a good sign. So go engage, turns into a fascination. Now we're gonna decide whether or not we're gonna fall in love with this. We're gonna turn it into a passion. If you're gonna turn it into a passion, one, you've got to start really gaining mastery. And going down the path of gaining mastery, it becomes a reciprocal relationship, meaning you're getting so good at something, it gives you abilities in the real world. So it allows you to be a first round draft pick, or it allows you to go and start setting records for your team, or to get paid more, whatever. It's now giving you something because you've gotten so good at it. And there's something about the more energy I put into it, the more it lets me do in the real world, that becomes this really interesting reciprocal relationship where it's this positive feedback loop of, I'm actually loving this, I'm enjoying it, there was intrinsic worth and interest and value, and now it's actually letting me do things. So that's what we'll call a passion. But I'm literally writing a book on this now, like how to shape yourself into whatever you want to become such that you actually love it, that you have the energy to see it through, that you know how to develop it into a passion so that you'll have the stick-to-itiveness that you're going to need to get to the other side of greatness.
Mm-hmm. A couple more questions before we move to some more fun stuff. God, I could sit here and talk for hours with you on this stuff. Something that I'm very familiar with is transition. Obviously, as an athlete, got a shelf life. You're going to, you know, and I think this is probably in any business. How do you start all over again? I mean, because that was my biggest thing. That's where I went through a depression after I got done playing football. I went through another one.
Oh, this is so fucking interesting.
After my third year out of the league, I'm working for CBS. Great people over there. I'm flying out to New York. I'm doing television. From the outside, everybody thinks that it's going great.
Right.
And it was going okay, but something wasn't there. And maybe I didn't fall in love with actually broadcasting more. Maybe I hadn't let go of football. Transition's tough. This is what I want to get from you. I was trying to be an actor too. And you talk about getting ass
kicked. Did you just put that in the past tense?
I've kind of put that on hold now.
Really?
Well, it's not that
Tony, we're going to have the real fucking conversation then.
I love this stuff. I've been working on this stuff for 20 years.
What's most this people, stuff?
Me, like mind, body, yep. and spirit. Leveling up myself
okay.
and the people around me. You ask anybody around
so
me.
So is that the second act? You're going
this,
to-
This is part of my second act is yeah. doing the football. I love broadcasting.
What do you mean doing the football?
Doing broadcasting. Okay. And, you know, yep. being a studio analyst, working with guys like Strahan, Terry, and Howie, and Michael Vick. And I love doing that. I love okay. showing up to work. I didn't love it the first 3 years, but now I love it. I'm working at Fox now. It's really taken off for me. And I've seen the results. Like I'm doing Thursday Night Football now. They're putting me more on the big desk with the big guys. I love, so that, and then I was also doing acting. Mm-hmm. And I liked acting and I still like it a lot, but I don't know if it's something that I love. Well, first of all, too, the results were there. Like the self-awareness, like, well, you're not booking jobs. It's not really working. But then doing this right here, this has been great for me. I love, and I'm just starting this. I'm really, really enjoying this. And it's been kind of inspired by you and watching other people doing what you do. So getting back to the question of transition, where I have been depressed, knocked down, coming from auditions, where you walk out of the room and you know, it's not even a question. Like, you know, you sucked. And I worked hard for it and it hurts. That's yeah. when it hurts, is because you think you're putting in the right effort and you're trying to approach it the right way. And it's still not working. It's still just not working for whatever reason. And I think I know why. But it takes a while to get to your why. It's not working. But one thing, when I've done talks for people, men and women have come up to me after the show. And when I talk about transition, it seems like that hits a lot of people. The people out there that are going, let's say they've done the company. Let's say they've had some success and now they're transitioning into something else. How do you navigate that? How do you deal with that all over again? And has your experience been up and down? Has it been depressing? Has it been great?
Not at all.
How's it been?
Phenomenal.
Mm-hmm.
So I have two keys, and this is one of those, Tony. One is your friend. I want you to internalize this, because this will change the way that you move forward. You have to become obsessed with learning. Like, that just has to be, if I were to peel you open, I would not find a heart inside of you. I would find a glowing orb of the desire to learn. And once that becomes the core reason that you exist, then all of a sudden it's the worse you are at something, now I won't say the better, but it doesn't matter. The degree to which you are bad at something only informs whether you want to put the time and energy into getting good. Because it's like, okay, maybe acting to get good, it's going to take just an inordinate amount of time. Maybe that, like, the effortlessness in front of camera, or the ability, like Nicole Kidman, her ability to disappear into a character is so surreal to me. I don't know how she does it. Mm-hmm. Like, that's just crazy. So maybe literally neurologically, there is a part of her brain, maybe, I'm guessing, that makes her able to so seamlessly transition. And I think about, from an acting perspective, I could never be an actor because I'm not able to control my micro expressions well. So, like, when people look at me, they always think I'm angry because I don't know how to effortlessly, like, hold my face in a given, like, thing. Yeah, it's a whole yeah. fucking problem for me. So when you're obsessed with learning, you're going to go into something and you're going to say, you know, obsession, okay? Your audience, we may lose them right now, but I'm going to be with you. You understand obsession, right? Mm-hmm. In a way where you look around at the rest of the world and you think, they don't understand obsession. They don't know what it takes, do they, Tony? Mm-hmm. Right?
they
right? Most yes, people, they,
yeah,
they,
yeah,
they don't
majority.
Get
majority. That's okay. why you have average and-
Now, most people don't understand how powerful obsession is, that it makes you think about it when you're in the shower, makes mm-hmm. you think about it when you're falling asleep, when you wake up, at the most inopportune moments, but your mind's yes. always working on that problem.
Mm-hmm.
Just there, on it. Now, when your deepest obsession is learning, suddenly the transition becomes, this is a new puzzle. I get to figure this out. So people, when I tell people, because I've said this from day one, I leave BuildQuest into a $1 billion business. People already told me, you're crazy. It's never going to work. And of course that works. And then the fun of that was solving the puzzle. Can we actually figure this out? And then I start Impact Theory. None of my identity is tied up in Quest. So leaving that was easy. I left that on a Tuesday. Impact Theory started on a Wednesday. I'm not joking. So it's like, didn't even think about the transition. For me, it was, I have a new puzzle to solve. I'm obsessed with things in my life. Okay, so you already get that. You know, like how it's ever present. It's always there. It's this hunger. It's a need. It's like a sickness that like I suck molecules out of the atmosphere in a desire to solve this thing. So I'm obsessed with solving puzzles. The puzzle is now Disney. The puzzle is so big. When I tell people I'm building the next Disney, I lose credibility. I don't gain it. Nobody goes, oh, well, he's done big things before. Of course he's going to do this. Bullshit. Everybody's like, this guy's out of his fucking mind. Yeah. He's a nobody. He's making comics in fucking obscurity. What is this guy thinking? He's never going to pull this off. He's a nice guy. I really like him, but he's never going to pull this off. This is madness. And all I'm looking at, sure, statistically speaking, I'm almost guaranteed to fail. But I'm only interested in, can I solve the problem? Mm-hmm. Can I figure this out? When you are obsessed with getting better, you have the self-awareness to identify what you want to get good at, what you can get good at. You leverage that, and every day is non-esteem destroying, because every time you fail, you're so obsessed with learning, it's just an opportunity to get better. And then you recognize that getting better and having skills deploys against the real world and allows you to do things people can't do. Then you can actually build things over time.
Let's talk about, you said you want to be rich. You got rich. You said you wanted a six pack. You got your six pack. Let's talk about that a little bit. What's your routine like?
Okay, so first it depends on what I'm trying to accomplish. So I don't hold abs year round. So full disclosure, I don't always walk around with six pack abs. Mm-hmm. But when I want to get really lean, I'll answer that first. So if I want to get really lean, I'm definitely going to be intermittent fasting, because to get lean, you have to tell your body burn fat. So I do a 20-hour daily fast. So every day I eat in a 4-hour window and I fast for 20 hours. My diet is primarily red meat, eggs, and white rice. Right now I'm easing myself towards, I'm going to do a carnivore experiment. So I'm not intaking any vegetables. Now I do cheat occasionally.
Okay.
So if you ever see me post saying I'm going to Vegas, I'm going to cheat. I'm going to be completely off the rails, everything out the window.
Everything. So like if you see, hey, the buffet over there has got fried chicken, you got to go try that. Tom.
Yes. 1,000%. And my weakness is French fries. So yeah.
French fries.
And I'm not afraid to cheat. Like, and I fully recognize it shortens my life and all of that, but it's fucking delicious. And so I do it on occasion. Yeah. So it's very rare though. It is very, very rare that I cheat.
Going back to the biohacks, what about for your brain? Do you, so
get
no.
Sleep. This is one where sleep, there is one thing that will make such a massive difference that until you've optimized that, don't even bother with anything else.
Okay.
Get sleep.
I agree with you.
So I prioritize sleep. I get as much sleep as I can.
How much do you sleep a night?
I sleep until I wake up. So it varies, but if I had to guess the average is 7 hours. Ballpark.
7 hours. You go to bed early? You go to like circadian rhythm, sun comes?
9 p.m.
9 p.m. every night you go to
like
bed?
Like it's a religion.
Really?
Yep. And then I wake up to an alarm, but it is very rarely. So I would say I wake up to an alarm probably once a month.
Uh-huh. So you're sleeping a lot. You got 9 o'clock, man, that's so damn early.
Is that when you're tired, right? I'll go to bed whether I'm tired or not, but I'm usually exhausted because I'm playing all out every day.
I read the book, Why We Sleep by Matthew Walker, PhD. He's a professor at Berkeley, but he's from London. But I talked to him. He talks about your chronotype for when you sleep, that everybody's different. Because back in the day when we were living in tribes, you not everybody can't go to sleep at the same time, because then you would be susceptible for the tiger to come in and eat your ass. Yep. So everybody is different. And
if you could get by with less sleep, would you?
Yeah, I would. But I need my sleep, and I've tried to.
All right. Lord knows if you could trade half of your wealth for the ability to only need 2 hours of sleep a night, would you do it?
No.
All your shit, Tony.
Hell no.
I would.
You trade half your wealth?
For sure.
But I'm not as rich as you. I need to, you know, I gotta get there first.
But half is half, right? So let me tell you, I would fucking do it in a heartbeat. And I remember being asked that question as a kid and I was like, no way, that's crazy. I would never do that. I like dreaming. I like sleeping. And then you become passionate about something and you're like, fuck this. The amount that I could get done if I didn't need to sleep. Because I'm not saying that you go through life feeling like you think you would feel on 2 hours. I'm saying you go through life, you need 2 hours, you feel like $1 million.
Yeah.
Oh my God. To have an extra 5 hours a day, you gotta be joking.
Especially you.
Oh my God. Dude, yeah, that one I would make. That would be a fair trade.
You said you meditate.
Fiendishly.
I get a lot out of meditation. And meditation is something I do twice a day. I do it right when I wake up, do it right when I go to sleep. Been doing it for a long time. Yep. Visualization, I think, is a form of meditation. Yes. Michael Jordan did that. Phil Jackson brought that with his Zen, his Buddhism. I think you can get there. I mean, there's different ways. I always tell people, you know, if we want to go to New York, we could fly there. Mm. Or we could drive there. We could ride a bike. We could moonwalk there. We could, you know, we could ride a skateboard. There's all these different ways to get to that point of the ecstatic is what they call it. Okay, a couple closing questions for you. Everybody loves food. Me and my wife were talking about this last night. You know, when people say, oh, I love food, it's like, well, no shit. Everybody loves food, like loves it. It's what we do. If you could make something healthy, what would you?
French fries.
French fries, yes. that's your thing.
Domino's pizza and French fries.
Domino's pizza?
I grew up in Tacoma, homie. I do not have expensive taste.
Have you been to Italy? Pizza.
Yes, and I've had the pizza there, and they should come and learn from Domino's. Oh, so funny, because I know how sacrilegious that is.
Oh, my but God. Like,
I legitimately, if I'm going to cheat, French fries is my number one. Uh-huh. But like a whole meal, that'd be tough to do just French fries. Uh-huh. So Domino's pizza. I literally just did it last weekend. It was glorious. It was glorious. It's so good.
Can't take you out of Tacoma.
You really can't. You can take the kid out of Tacoma, but you can't take Tacoma out of the kid. That is for sure.
There is definitely, there are Domino's pizzas in Italy. I've seen pizza.
Because it's good.
Oh God.
It's so good. I like a little cardboard to my pizza. What can I say? I don't know what it is, man. Have you ever had a Gino's pizza?
No.
They might've been kind of regional when I was growing up. Oh, they were so cheap. It was amazing. It was like the pepperoni was, they were in squares, like really small, tiny squares. And there was, I don't know, enough to cover maybe 1/10 of the pizza. You'd put it in the oven and then it was so flimsy that you would just fold it in half and then eat it like a sandwich. Oh God, I love those things. If I could get them now, I would. Yeah. Like I am very distressed, my friend, by how much your childhood wires you. I really don't like that. And that does not fit into my desired beliefs about how much we can change. And to this day, a Gino's pizza, it just does it for me.
Just does it for you. Yeah. Ours was a Little Caesars pizza.
Caesar.
If you could sit down with anybody in history to have a conversation with, who would you sit down with? And it could be anybody. It could be somebody from your past, from your family, from living, dead, history, mythical. Let's not go mythical. Let's go real.
Real, I'm going to go with, I've just had a long-standing fascination with Albert Einstein. So that one's really cheap and cheesy and I feel a bit bad. Lao Tzu would be amazing. He influenced me a lot growing up. Lao Tzu wrote The Tao Te Ching.
Okay.
And that book, Ancient Chinese Philosophy, and Yoda introduced me to Eastern philosophy. Yoda is basically spouting Taoism and Buddhism.
Okay.
So, which is what makes him such an enduring character. Once I realized that he was actually spouting Taoism and Buddhism, I started reading Taoism and Buddhism and found the book, The Tao Te Ching, which is very accessible to people. If you've never had anything sort of remotely spiritual in your life, read that book. Mm-hmm. And it planted the seeds of like growth mindset and all that stuff. It's funny saying it out loud now. That is even before The Matrix, where a lot of that thinking started. And the whole notion of be like water, my friend, if you know the Bruce Lee quote, quoting The Tao Te Ching.
Yeah.
So that's somebody I would love to like, how do you pull that kind of wisdom out 2,000 years ago? It's just bananas.
Oh, amazing. Amazing. Maybe he was taking psychedelics. Who knows?
Honestly, I'm actually very interested. They have that whole, what do they call it? The psychedelic ape theory. That's not right, but something like that, where it's like they apes that came across psychedelics and it impacted their brain and opened up their minds to language and that becomes us. I don't know anything about it, but
I don't know. I'm going to bring on an expert one day. Maybe they could explain the stuff. You mentioned a book. What is the top three books you would recommend to our audience?
All right, here we go. In order. I have them on my website, by the way, impacttheory.com. My reading list, there's like 29 books, something like that, in order. First is Mindset by Carol Dweck. Second is Extreme Ownership by Jocko Willink and Leif Babin. And then third, if I'm not mistaken, is The Obstacle is the Way by Ryan Holiday. Man's Search for Meaning is up there, but I won't be cheeky. I'll give you those, the first three.
Uh-huh. Very good.
There it is. They will help you build your mindset.
I think so. Any closing remarks?
Dude, you are an extraordinary human. People will get that in the podcast. They've known your stats and all that. I'm so excited that you're doing this. And I hope that you put in the energy to become extraordinary, because you'll bring something out in people that I think will be unique. Your own story is transformational. It's one of the greatest human stories ever that I've ever heard. It is so good. So yeah, I'm super excited. Very grateful to have gotten to know you. Thank you for having me on. I'm honored to be one of the first. And that's it, man. I hope people really dive in.
Well, Tom, let me tell you, it's been an honor to have you sitting here. It seems it was meant to be. When I was going through that transitional stage after my third year out of the NFL, your videos spoke to me. And I said that at the top of the show. And so to be able to sit here with you and talk shop here, because I'm a geek for this stuff. I'm a geek for success. Like, yeah. I'm a geek for learning and growing mind, body, and spirit. So you are the epitome of that. And I appreciate you coming on.
Thank you, man. Thanks for having me.
Hey, what's up, guys? If you enjoyed the podcast, let me know about it at TonyGonzalez88 on all social media platforms. I would love to hear from you. Feedback, what you liked, what you didn't like. I'm a big boy. I can take it because I want to make sure that I'm helping. You know, I want to help all you guys, gals, level up, be the best version of yourselves. We're all in this together. And the only way I can help you is by you helping me and letting me know in the comment section. Like I said, it's on all social media outlets at TonyGonzalez88.